Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein. This is Perek Yud of Sefer Hosea, 10th chapter of the book of Hosea. Interestingly, the Mechilta in Az Yashir, in the Shirat Hayam, in the song that the Jews said after they come out of the sea, so the Mechilta in the middle there says, where it says, that the enemy said, I'm going to chase the Jewish people and then I'll split up the booty, the loot, the spoils of war. Mechilta says that was actually where the beginning of the Shiva should have been, because it talks about the first stage, the first step in the Jewish, in the whole set of incidents. And then it points, and it says, and the only reason why it's not that way is because in Vukhim Vukhar Batorah, because Tanakh doesn't always care about sequence. And a very important idea that should be thought about a lot, because we tend to think very much in terms of sequence. So the fact that Chazal in various contexts are comfortable with lack of sequence, and Rashi is more comfortable, and Radam and Ramban is somewhat less comfortable, and he tries to generally have it be in sequence. All of that is part of the atmosphere and framework of Torah that's important to keep in mind if you want to get an accurate picture of what it is that the Torah or the Navi is trying to say. So the Mechilta says that, but then the parallel example that it offers is our Perek, where it says that really the book of Hosea should have started with Perek Yud. But Ein Mukdam Mukhar BaTorah. Now, the reason that it should start with Perek Yud could be a very technical one, in that we are about to, in this chapter, hearken back to the origins of the Jewish people, and much of the chapter is a complaint or a bemoaning of the wasted potential that there is in the Jewish people, and that Hashem set us up to be a productive and good and appropriate people, and we have wasted that opportunity. So you could say it's just similar to Amar Oyev Radov Asika Chalek Shalah. It's similar to that, and that's what's going on there. But it could be that the themes of this chapter are also fairly fundamental, or should be seen as fundamental, to the message that Hosea is trying to get across. Some set of those themes start right at the beginning, where Pasuk Aleph says, Gefen bokeik Yisrael peri yishavelo, kerov lefiryo, hirbala mizbechot, ketov learto, hetivu matzevot. So Gefen bokeik Yisrael, it's a vine that has, in Rashi's words, has lost all of its good fruit. It drops its good fruit. And the English, the JPS says it, it's a ravaged vine, and its fruit is like it. It's pre-shavelo, its fruit is like it. So Rashi says, what it means is, and the rest of the pasuk explains it, kerov l'firyo, when Hashem gave us a lot of fruit, a lot of success, a lot of property, a lot of economic success and financial success, as Radak points out, when we had all of that good, you know what we did? We used it to make mizbechot. When it was good in the land, they made matzevot, they made places of worship, and these places of worship are not places of worship in the sense that Hashem wants them to be. So either they could be idols, or they could be the bamot, and the kinds of bamot that we've seen and spoken about and are spoken about so much in the book of Melachim, where even if the Jews are worshiping Hashem, they're worshiping Hashem not in a way that Hashem advocated or wanted, an important central theme. And this theme now, the way that Hosea is expressing it is, it's not only that they did it, but that it's going back, it's going to be going back all the way to the origins of the Jewish people, to the earliest times of the Jewish people. So the idea being that one of our central flaws that Hosea is pointing out to us and is talking about is that from our very beginnings, we have insistently neglected the message that Hashem is most interested in us having. So, and when we get good, right? So, a bunch of the book of Hosea is about how we're going to get punished and Hashem is on the verge of punishing us. Part of what you have in this parak is sort of an explanation for that. There's one that we've sort of seen before, but that comes back again and needs to be said repeatedly to absorb and to understand that we have wasted the potential that Hashem gave us. We've wasted the opportunities that Hashem gave us, and financial success was only an excuse for us to do what we wanted and not what Hashem wanted. Pasuk bet chalak libam atay yeshamu hu ya'arof mizbechotam. So chalak libam is their hearts are split up, are divided, and therefore they have guilt. Hu ya'arof mizbechotam. Hashem is going to pull apart their altars. Yishudeid matzevotam, and take apart their matzevot, their pillars, their stones on which they provide sacrifices, right? So a mizbeach is built of many stones, and a matzevah is generally seen as being built of one stone. But this chalak libam, so Rashi's chalak libam is mimeni, that their hearts turned away from me, they're divided from me, and that's going to lead to the guilt that will lead them into destruction. But then he quotes another aspect in the name of Chazal, and it's a well-known thing. The Chazal suggests that no, it's Chalak Libam when they were divided as a people. That's when they began to fully get their punishment for all of their other sins. Meaning that Chazal's tradition was that if the Jewish people managed to be unified as a whole and not to be... Now, unified as a whole does not mean they all do the same thing, right? It's not that they're saying if 70% of the Jewish people are worshipping idols in the name of peace, everybody else should join and worship idols. But that in earlier generations, when, even when Jews were worshipping idols, so even when Jews were violating the Torah, they managed to create some kind of a peaceable working relationship among each other. How you do that is always a big question. It's a question for those who care about Torah at least as much as for the idol worshippers themselves. Because the question is, in what ways are you allowed to, and this is a halakha question as much as another kind of a question, but in what ways are you allowed to support such people and work with such people and have comfortable relationships with such people, and what ways are you supposed to be always rebuking them and always fighting with them and whatever. But that's what the understanding of the pasuk is, Chalak Libam, that it was their descent into internal strife that led to them really being ready for the punishment that they deserve for so long. Pasuk Gimel, Ki Ata Yomruin Melech Lanu, Lo Yareinu Et Hashem HaMelech Ma Yaaseh Lanu. And they, of course, as is traditional for Jews, at least in Chazal's portrayal of Jews, or in the Nevi'im's portrayal of Jews, they get the wrong message from events that happen. So in Pasuk Gimel, what they say to themselves is, as the Radak says, when they go into exile, they're going to say, we have no king. And it's as if that king has, meaning Hashem has no power to save us from our enemies, or the king that we had. And then they're going to realize, that's what he thinks it is, Ki Ata Yomru, soon they will say. So, in Pasuk Aleph and Bet, we're talking about that they, what they did wrong, that they were a vine, they had good, and they wasted their financial opportunities, they wasted their bounty. And then at a time when they turned against each other, they got punished. And now they're getting punished, they're going to come to realize that they were wrong for turning and looking for a king, a theme that we've seen in Hosea before. And this is obviously a theme that's important when he's dealing with the northern kingdom, because not only did they turn for a king, like everybody in the Jewish people did, but then they also turned away from the king that was eventually provided for them as the king for the whole people. They turned away and they became faithless to that king. So those are all themes that are very alive for Hosea, and that's what we're saying here, that will be part of their comeuppance when they go into exile. Dibrud devarim alot shav karod berit ufarach kerosh mishpat al talmei sadai. So then they say a lot of things. They make agreements, they make covenants, they make pacts, but they don't keep to them. So at least that's the way Rashi has it, right? That they become faithless. Alot shav is yishaval hasheker and karod berit la'akum, to idol worship, and therefore they're going to have a lot of yisurim, a suffering. Dibrud ufarach kerosh. Karosh is a bitter grass, right, that is going to sprout. So the idea being that their wrongs in terms of breaking the covenants with Hashem and making false pacts and false deals, and the Radak similarly has it that the dibru devarim, the words that they've spoken, are that they consulted Yerovim and all of his advisors consulted on how to keep the kingship in their hands, which really harkens back to the previous pasuk, that they were focused on their own sense of rule and rulership and kingship, and therefore they spoke about the fact that they were going to keep the people from going to Yerushalayim, and they made a covenant about this, and it was a ridiculous covenant, or Shvuat Shav is the way the Radak calls it, because it was an attempt to nullify the Torah and mitzvot that God made, and there's no way to do that, and therefore it leads to them reaping this rosh, these bitter flowers, on their roads, on their pathways. I would just point out that the Medrash, the Psikta Rabbati, here says that there is no Navi who hits the Jewish people who then doesn't come back and heal up that wound that they made. This is very similar to a Medrash that we quoted in the previous chapter, so it's sort of a theme within Medrash that when you see rebuke and you see admonishment, you shouldn't think that's what the Navi is interested in, that's what the Navi produces. It's more of a question of, that's the Navi's job, but then that Navi will always return to that theme itself and come back and give some kind of a healing for it. And so the way he says it here is that this pasuk is taken as an example of, this is a strike at the Jewish people's faithfulness and their ability to say and be trusted in their words. And then in the final chapter of Hosea, the Tshuva Yisrael chapter, it says, "Kechui machem divarim v'shuvu al Hashem." Take with you words and turn to Hashem, implying that words will be good enough. That'll be the words of Tshuva, as long as they're sincere and honest, they'll be acceptable to Hashem. So that the underlying message of that medrash would be not only that Hosea is not to be seen in one-sided, but that even within the things that he most protests, the things in which he says the Jews are most lacking, he nonetheless himself is given the vision that those will be the ways, or some of the ways, in which the Jews will get back to the good graces of Hashem. Pasuk Hey Le'eglot Beit Aven Yaguru Shechan Shomeron Kival Alav Amo Uchmarav Alav Yagilu Al Kivodo Kigalami Menu. So the egel here, the calf in Beit El. Radak points out there was also a calf in Dan, but we don't speak about that one so much. He's pointed out several times, I haven't always been careful to mention it, that the calf, the egel that was in Beit El, you don't mention the Dan one because it wasn't the major one, so the calf that's in Beit El is going to be destroyed, and they'll be afraid, the people of Shomron will be afraid, and they'll bemoan it, they'll mourn over it, it and its priests, who once upon a time, Alav Yagilu, had been thrilled with it and enjoyed it, but they will be upset, Al Kivodo Gigala Mimeno, over all of its honor that had gone away from it. So that this is pointing out or complaining about the fact that it's not only that they're now caught up in the spell of this egel, but even when this egel gets destroyed eventually, they won't immediately be lost from its spell. They won't immediately say, oh, that was crazy. How could we have believed in such a thing? How could we have been involved in such a thing? That's sadly and unfortunately not what's going to happen. What's going to happen is that they will be saddened by the loss, and they will be upset about the loss, and they will react in those kinds of ways. So that's something to watch. You know, there was, in this country at least, I remember a lot of talk about the fact, let's say, both in Afghanistan and Iraq, there was this idea that as soon as whatever dictators were in whatever either one of those countries, so in one it was the Taliban and the other one it was Saddam Hussein, there was the idea that the masses were completely downtrodden by that reign, by that inappropriate regime, and as soon as it left, everybody would fall in and rejoin an appropriate and a proper appreciation of the way society was supposed to work, and there was some evidence for that, and there were celebrations, and there were joy, and there were this, and there were that, but then it wasn't so clear that people were so upset and so bothered by the loss of those regimes as it were, as we continue to work our way through this. So, whatever the truth is about those circumstances, I think it's relevant here just to watch and to see and to notice that what the Navi is predicting, and the Navi understands that the people to be, is that they will, when the time comes for these idols, for these agalim, for these calves to be destroyed, the people will bemoan it and mourn it and be upset about it. Pasuk Vav Gamoto Lashru Yuval Mincha Lamelech Yarev Boshna Ephraim Yikach V'Yavosh Yisrael Me'atzato. So once it's all destroyed, once it's all broken up, it's going to be brought to, the gold will be brought to Ashur, and so the rest of the pasuk is also in, along those lines. It'll become a mincha, a gift for the king of Ashur, who had overseen the conquest, and he'll take, and it'll be embarrassing to Ephraim that it's going to happen, and all of Israel will be embarrassed because of Atatu, because of all the plans, because of all of the counsel and the wisdom the king of Ashur had brought to bear that led to all of this downfall, or alternatively, Atatu, from its own ideas that it had thought and the ways that it had thought to act. I would just point out in the reference to, back in the previous pasuk, the reference to Beit Aven, like Lot Beit Aven, and pasuk Hey. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Mem Gimel Amid Bet says that in general we're not allowed to have. I'm sorry, in Samach Gimel Amid Bet says we're not allowed to have Leit Sanuta. So Leit Sanuta generally means mocking something just for the sake of mocking it, just for the sake of tearing it down. It's not allowed. And except for the late Sanut, they do have Avodah Zarah. That's allowed, and they quote it from our Pasuk of Beit, Dabrulek Lod Beit Aven, because it's really Beit El, and Aven is a name for something that has no value. So they change the name of Beit El for the purpose of mocking Avodah Zarah. So when it comes to Avodah Zarah, the tearing down, this is the destructive kind of attitude toward it is acceptable, but not in anything else. So I think that's very interesting Jewish perspective, right? That and you see this in comedy, especially. There are comedians, and there are kinds of comedy which are largely constructive, or if not constructive, maybe that's not the right word, but they are enjoying or noting and taking humor in the foibles of human beings. And the point of it is not so much to make a point about what should or shouldn't be, or what's right or wrong. The point is more just to enjoy the ridiculousnesses of some human situations. So that's comedy. But then there's comedy that's really about tearing down, and about destroying, and about being negative. And so that's Leitzanut. And Leitzanut is something that's not allowed, and Leitzanim, we've spoken about this on other occasions, are among those groups that are seen as not seeing, as not being roe pnei shechina, as not being privileged to enjoy the divine presence whenever that'll come about. So that's a sort of a side point here, but that comes up because the exception. The exception is, when it comes to Avodah Zarah, we in fact have the right to be fully mocking and just tearing down, because it is Avodah Zarah. So the kingdom of Shamron and the king of Shamron are like the foam on the water, on the water, meaning that it disappears very, very quickly, and they too will disappear very quickly. So then they're gonna be destroyed there. Their altars and their places of idol worship, and the sins of the Jewish people will come back to, or the northern kingdom will come back to haunt them, and their altars will be so thoroughly destroyed that they will have thorns and thistles growing on them, and they will be so upset about what's going on that they will call out to the mountains, Kasunu, cover us over, and tell the hills to fall on them. Meaning that they'll hope and long for death. So this is that whole issue of hoping and longing for death is one that we could profitably take up another time. The whole question of that level of frustration and how inappropriate it is, and how one has to struggle against that. But here you have an example of them seeing how low they have sunk, and they see that as something that would lead them to long for death. So this is the end of this part of the perek. Then we move into a new parsha, which doesn't end at the end of the perek, but we will end at the end of the chapter, and it's going to be now sort of trying to get the Jews to realize where they went wrong and bring them back, right? The point of prophecy is never just to be destructive. It's always, even if it doesn't bother mentioning that, it's always a search for the key to getting people to change and to grow and to develop, excuse me, in productive ways, and that's what is being sought in all of these situations. So now in the second half of the paragraph, we begin to look for that as well. So in Pasuk Tet, Hosea says, Mimeha Giv'ah Chatata Yisrael. From the days of Giv'ah, you sinned. And of course, the question is, what Giv'ah are we talking about? So, Shamama Delotis again by Giv'ah Milchama Albane Alva. They stand at Givan, they're not going to be overtaken by a war on the people who do the wrong thing, on the scoundrels, is what the JPS English has it. So Radak puts it in that time, not Mimeha Givan as in a long time ago, but Rashi thinks that is, again, as we saw in a previous chapter, a reference to Pilegesh B'Givah, or a reference to Shaul being king at Givah, or another possibility is also Pesel Micha, is that in the book of Shoftim you have a story of a guy, a Levi, who goes up and he has no way of making a living, and therefore he makes a Pesel, and he does it again, it's near Givah. So he offers all these possibilities, and he says, and this the Radak agrees with, the end half of the Pasuk is that they see that those people sort of got away with it, and therefore they think that they themselves will get away with it as well, and therefore they allow themselves to act in certain ways. So that expectation and that assumption that retribution won't come is certainly a important factor
in allowing people to sin. Pasuk Yud Be'avati Ve'esareim Ve'usifu Alehem Amim Ve'osrem Nishtei Onotam. So Hashem says, it's not true. If I want to, Be'avati, as soon as I want to, I will be able to bring Yisurim. I'll be able to bring destruction or suffering, whatever it needs, and I will gather against them various nations as I want to bring them punishment for their various wrongs. So they get the impression that they are free of divine providence, they are free of divine punishment, and therefore Hashem says, no, when I want to, I can. And then Radak says, no, it's more than that. It's when they don't accept the Musar of my Nevi'im. I send Nevi'im, so I send prophets, and they don't listen to them. So then I will bring upon them other nations, because those will bring a more sure form, a more recognizable form of actual punishment and actual suffering. Meaning if the Navi comes and says, the prophet comes and says, you're doing the wrong thing, you have to turn away from it, the people can reject that. And they don't see the consequences for rejecting it. But when other nations come and fight against us and destroy us and punish us or take us into exile, that they have to recognize. So on Onotam, right, the Australian state Onotam, so the JPS English has it harnessing them for two furrows, but the Radak points out, or that Onotam says, it's the comparison here is to have Yehuda and Ephraim, the northern and the southern kingdom, to two cows who are trying to dig furrows, as the English has it, and Hashem is saying, I wanted them to do straight furrows in the fields. I wanted them to plow straight and properly, and they refuse to, and they continually don't do so. And that metaphor is going to carry us through the next several psukim. So, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Ephraim Eglam Milumada Ohavti Ladush Vani Avarti Al Tuv Tzavara Arkiv Ephraim Yacharosh Yehuda Yisaded Lo Yaakov. So, and I said, Hashem is saying, first of all, Ephraim is an Eglah Milumada. Ephraim is an Eglah, so this is going to be a calf, because we're now referring again back to the very beginnings of its past, that it's an Eglah Milumada. It is a calf that learned from its very young ages how to properly plow, and it didn't want to, Ohavti Ladush, but it rather would thresh, meaning it would go off and do the wrong thing, and it would ruin what it was supposed to be doing, and Hashem says, I did it in a very nice way, Avartel Tutsara, meaning I left its neck not so damaged or not so marked up by the plow, and it, Ephraim, nonetheless wouldn't do it. And the point was that Arkiv Ephraim, that it was going to be Ephraim, was going to do the light first plowing, and then Yehuda would do the main plowing, and then Yaakov would come along and do the final plowing. So the point of all this being that Hashem is noting how well he had set it up, and yet Ephraim rejects and refuses to do what it's supposed to do. I would point out that in Masechet Avot, we know in Masechet Avot, we have the statement of Elisha ben Avuya, who says, Lomed yelel mahu domeh, somebody learns when they are young, to what are they similar? They're similar to somebody, to paper, to words written on a new paper, right? To ink written on a very new paper, meaning there's no other things written on it, and therefore the paper is extremely legible and very easily read. That's the version we have in Avot that most of us know. But in Masechet Avot, Rabbi Natan quotes several different versions of that, or similar versions of that. One of them is Rabbi Nehorai. Rabbi Nehorai is a very interesting figure, because Rabbi Nehorai in the Mishnah Avot is somebody who, it's a long story. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, who was the prime student of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, that we know from Avot as well. And the story that's told in Avot Rabbi Natan is that he chose to live in a place where there was no Torah. And all the other people went to a place where there was a lot of Torah, so they could be fortified by the people around them in their study of Torah. And he felt that he didn't need that because of his supremacy in his learning and his knowledge of Torah. And eventually lost everything, and then they prayed for him and he got it back. So he called Rabbi Nehorai, because he got back the light. So he says, this Rabbi Nehorai says, if you learn when you're young, what do you like? You like an eglah that they trained to the plow when it was young. And then quotes our pasuk. So what's the advantage of an eglah that was trained to the plow when it was young? It knows how to plow better. It's seen as a better plowing animal. So that idea is being transferred then to learning Torah as well. It's not true, sadly and unfortunately, but it's not true that if you learn the same Torah, let's say one person learns Masechta Makot, another learns Masechta Makot, but one learns it when they're 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever the earliest time they're ready for it would be, another one doesn't start learning until they're 15, so that's not the same thing. In that context, there's a famous story about the Rav that I just think is a beautiful story. I think it makes a very, very important point, where supposedly, I don't know who the person was, but supposedly somebody approached the Rav, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and said, you know, Rabbi Soloveitchik, I don't understand something. You're very smart. So this man says to the Rav, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, you're a very smart man, but I'm also a very smart man, and you work hard at learning Torah, and I work hard at learning Torah. And he says, and I cannot come close to doing what you do with a piece of learning. He says, why is that? Meaning, so it's an interesting question, right? You could have thought the answer would be, well, and not that the Rav would have said it this way, but it might have been true nonetheless, that the answer would be, well, I'm a genius and you're not, right? I just have a talent and a skill for Torah that's unreplicable and I'm just gifted in that way. Could have made that argument, could have been said. Maybe that's the truth for all I know. What's enlightening, I think, is the Rav's answer, though, which doesn't rely on that. Meaning, the Rav, in the answer, grants the premise that when it comes to pure intelligence and pure skill, they're in the same ballpark with each other. So if you grant that premise, what's the Rav going to say? So the Rav says, because by the time I was 12, I had been to the Minchas Chinuch twice. I mean, the Minchas Chinuch is a commentary on the Sefer HaChinuch. It's a remarkable book. You know, I've been learning a little bit of it recently, and people sometimes see me with it, and there are jokes in the world of learning about the Minchas Chinuch that he relies too much on certain questions and certain chilukim, certain distinctions. So people who I don't think have learned it at all will say, oh, you know, he talked a lot about, let's say, Chatzi Shifcha Chatzi Eved a lot, which is a topic that he raises a lot. It's a very important example to him because it captures certain questions very well for him. But it's a remarkable work, and it's a work full of learning, and a work full of really important ideas and questions and thoughts and approaches. So, as I think is evidenced by the fact that if this story is true, the Rav's father felt it was worth the Rav's while to spend his time as a young man learning this. And the point of the story, I think, is, or the point that the Rav was trying to make, is that you can't replace Girsuta Diyankata. You can't replace the learning that you do when you're young. It's not only that you remember it better, it's that it shapes you a certain way. So here too, that's what Rabbi Nehorai is telling us, the Mishnah of Avot. Meaning, if you read the Mishnah in Avot itself, it just says, like, you're written on a paper, means you'll remember it better and it'll stick better. But I think Rabbi Nehorai might be saying it'll also train you and shape you as a person better, and that's a piece of what needs to be going on. So that is, in Pasuk Yid Aleph, what Hashem is complaining about. So they had all the advantages. They were shaped in that way, and yet they refused to accept the discipline of Torah and the discipline of plowing the world the way Hashem wanted them to. And that's the way Pasuk Yud Bet comes along, at least for Rashi, it's about Torah, and Pasuk Yud Bet, and for Radak, it's more about mitzvot in general. The Pasuk says, Ziru lachem litztaka kitzu lefi chesed. Plant yourselves according to tzedakah, according to charity, and then reap according to your kindness. Niru lachem nir. So niru lachem nir means literally plow and break through fresh ground. Ve'et lidroshat Hashem, and know the time to teach for Hashem. Yavov yaret tzedek lachem, until somebody comes along and teaches you full righteousness. So ziru lachem means plant, and litzdaka, in charity, and in chesed is kindness. So near lechem near Rashi says it means isku b'Torah, and misham tolmedu lalecha b'derech tova likabel yitzara kaze shehu nar et hasadeh. It's like when you clear the field, you've overturned the field, getting rid of any weeds or any leftovers that weren't harvested and will just be a barrier to the next year's planting. So that's what Nir Lachem Nir is. You turn over the field again and again. So Rashi says, yeah, keep planting or keep plowing, if plowing is the metaphor in Rashi's version for learning the Torah to teach you the right way to be, and then you can do the right actions. Radak thinks Nir Lachem Nir means just in terms of the actions. Don't ever give up on the action that you're supposed to be doing. So whether or not it's about the study of Torah, the study of Torah is certainly a huge theme for Rashi in various of his commentaries, and for Radak, not that he was against Talmud Torah at all, but it's not as much as of a recurring theme. So he thinks that all this is talking about doing the right kinds of actions, and that's where they're going wrong. So it comes back once again to remind us that Hosea, for as much as he complains about Avodah Zarah, it's not only about Avodah Zarah, it's about the lack of the appropriate and proper actions that Jews are supposed to be doing for each other. There may be a connection there, a correlation, but that's what he's complaining about here. So And then in the Radak points out that Chazal says Ziru lechem mitzdaka ketu lefi chesed is that the reward for chesed, which is when you do kindness to others rather than just giving gifts, but when you help others out in various ways, is more assured and more certain than for tzedaka, because in tzedaka it's planting, so planting is an uncertain, even in our times, when farming and agriculture become much more certain than they used to be, it's an uncertain thing as to how much you'll reap for it, whereas when it comes to the harvest, you know what you're harvesting, you already see it already. So here it says, katsu if you chesed, you'll harvest according to your chesed, and those will be time to search out Hashem, pasuk yudgimul charashtem resha avlata ketzartem achaltem prichachash kivatachta bedarkecha. And instead of plowing, so in Rashi's version, instead of plowing, searching for Torah, right? Instead of plowing for that and searching for that, they have plowed evil and they've reaped iniquity, they've reaped badness, and they've eaten, therefore, the fruits of all of this treachery, kachash, like from earlier in the chapter, when they say, speaking falsely, because they trust in their own ways, they trust in their heroes. V'kam sha'on v'amecha v'chol mivtzarecha yushad, and therefore you're going to reap all of this, and what you're going to reap is war in your people, and all of your fortresses, all of your mighty places are going to be plundered. Kishod Shalmon Beit Arbel, Shalman Beit Arbel Biyom Milchama Emal Banim Rut Dasha. As a famous example of their times, they knew, as Shalman had done to Beit Arbel, right? Radak says, Oyev Yadua Hayak, he was a well-known enemy, and he came on Beit Arbel suddenly, and he completely destroyed it, and he killed mothers and children. So in many wars, people observe the nicety of not killing the women and the children. He killed everybody. And it was a horrible tragedy. It was a horrible destruction. Everybody knew it. And that's why Hoshea points out, Kacha asa lachem Beit El. This is what Beit El is going to lead to you. Ne'ra'at re'atchem, because of all your very evil. Bashachar nidmo nidma melech Yisrael. And when the time comes, Bashachar, meaning when the morning, the dawn of the days in which these things will be properly dealt with, so the king, your king, is going to be perished. He's going to be completely destroyed. So, especially if the Mechilta is right, that this is where it really would have started, we do see here captured many of the central themes that we've seen in the book. That the problem is that, given the great start the Jewish people had, and especially the Northern Kingdom, and given the minimal or relatively minimal requirements Hashem made of them, our perfidy and our failure to observe what Hashem wanted becomes that much more problematic, that much more distressing. And it's not only that we turn to idol worship, that in and of itself would have been certainly bad enough, but it's that it also then led to other things, to a lack of friendship and of collegiality among the Jewish people, and that we saw was one of the suggestions for why the punishment, for why and when the punishment would come, that until there was this loss of collegiality, until such time as the Jews had given up or had lost their ability to deal nicely with each other, they weren't yet going to be punished. And then the whole thing of loss of Torah, loss of connection of Torah, and all of those aspects of it were pieces of the puzzle as to what leads to the predictions that we have, that everything's going to be destroyed and we're going to lose everything. It was the self-reliance, the belief that they go their own ways and not bear the consequences of it, not bear punishment for it, not lose out for it. All of that fueled, and that's what Hoshea is complaining about, is upset about, is trying to get the Jews to recognize. All that leads them on the road to their, in the Northern Kingdom's case, their very close to come destruction, and is the seed of what is going to go wrong for them. Have a great day.